This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Let's go talk about another case. This is having a hearing later in the week, and we'll be covering it Friday morning. Alec Murdaugh is back in front of the new judge, Deborah McCaslin, and the paper has been flying all week. Prosecutors just filed to use his own 2023 testimony against him. Every admission read straight to the new jury. They're also asking the judge to ban any talk of another suspect and keep the polygraph evidence out entirely. I know you guys aren't confused about who you think killed Maggie and Paul. I don't think I am either. But a lot of you guys want to know whether the state's new playbook actually seals this or blows it. I understand the arguments going in here of we don't want any talk of third party. And we also want to keep things that are going into the jury to be of a certain ilk, if you will. We don't want to, the certain things we want to add in here, like Alec's testimony about his deceptiveness, about everything he said in the first round. Will it make it in? That's what this pretrial motion is going to be all about, and we'll see where it goes. The state wants, one of the questions is to read his 2023 testimony to the new jury. The I lied to investigators for a year and a half, that sort of stuff, in his own words. The listener who made the comment said, part of me is cheering. Let his mouth convict him twice. But if I'm being honest, if the judge says yes, hasn't the retrial basically already happened? I don't know. If you're letting in testimony from that previous trial, is it? Should his full testimony be played back or read back in a new trial for everyone to take in? And does it? Would it, I guess, even have the same weight that it did in round one, where suddenly we learned at the last minute that Alec Murdaugh had been lying the whole time? Because we didn't know that until he went on the stand. Right. That element of shock and suspense is now just part of the story. It's not part of the actual, oh my God, moments in the court. I don't know. Robin, what do you think? Should the judge allow a piece of that testimony in, or that whole testimony in, to the new trial, even considering that trial was viewed to be, you know, not valid, and we gotta go.
I don't know why you wouldn't. I mean, it's again, just channeling my inner Bob Mata, who we love, and I learned so much about what defense does and what their whole role in these things is in upholding the Constitution and make sure it's legal and fair. And you can imagine, you know, the suppression things are going to put in there, and they're going to try to suppress everything they possibly can. But I don't know if it was in there before, they'd have to come up with another reason to suppress it. I mean, you can see why they're not doing as much financial stuff, because that was deemed in the appeals court as too much. And I don't know why or how you'd be able to get rid of this. I think it's completely appropriate to have in there, because just because it's being retried doesn't mean you can't do the same things you did last time. That's what the defense is going to try to get rid of and toss out. But that's also what the prosecution is going to hold on to if it worked before. And you can see their whole intention behind everything. They're trying to do all they can to remove all the reasonable doubt that could be presented to the jury.
Well, I think
that's it.
I think it's about the way it's being presented to the jury. It's on the record now. So if he were to go back and say, no, I wasn't down at the kennels, he'd be impeaching himself. That's on the record. That could be brought into play, which the judge may make a ruling like that of like, well, if you open the door to it, we can call you out on it. Or it may be something to the effect of, well, here's the record of what you say happened. Follow that record, that story that you've admitted you did, and we don't necessarily have to go, and by the way, he lied about it for all that time. And then finally, the play at issue is whether or not going to the jury and saying you lied about it for all of that time, when it's now just flatly on the record. So it would kind of impeach him a bit, but he's not, you know, he's not really trying to be impeached in a second trial if he just followed through and with
it's
the story.
It's more about him. It's more about presenting he lied rather than it is about the fact he was there.
Yeah.
Because that's more of an impact, saying you lied, because juries don't like when they're being lied to. So I don't know why, again, I don't know.
I mean, he could take the stand again. That's the next question, is if his old testimony comes in either way, what does he do? Does he take the stand again to explain the first time, to explain why he lied? I mean, that's what he did in the first trial. He went up there and said, yes, I lied, and here's why. Because, oh, what a tangled web we weave, according to Alec. And then went into, when he started lying, he started telling people this, he had to keep the story going because otherwise he'd look shitty. And it was because he was on drugs, this is according to him, and this and that. And you know what? I kind of buy that might be why he lied, of why he was down there. I'm not buying that he didn't have anything to do with this, but if we're, Alec works in segments. Alec is very compartmentalized in the way he handles things. And he's talking specifically about why he lied, not about the murder, not about this, but in the context of simply the box over here of why he said he was not there. I mean, the motivation does make sense as to why he said it once and kept it going.
And you highlighted it, you know, right there. You presented the reasonable doubt. I could believe it. I mean, you said it. So, yeah, so having him, I think having him, so it's a risky thing. And you know, defense attorneys never going to want their client to really testify, especially in this case. But because he can be slaughtered on cross on this, but if he can rely on that drug-induced craze, you can garner sympathy because, you know, because I think some people will give sympathy for that if he presents properly, and I say properly, in other words, he actually means it's not part of some sort of, you know, presentation he's given like he did last time with the fake tears and a blubbering and all the crazy yucky snot pouring out of him. But it's enough that does present that reasonable doubt, because that's all, it looks like from our standpoint, that's all the defense is trying to do, is give reasonable doubt so that he can't serve.
Well, I mean, that's what the civil attempt was at suing Becky Hill for the $600,000, which got thrown out this last week. Yep. So all of the depositions and all that they were going to try and do, it was essentially a fishing expedition, in my opinion, to try and find something that they could poke a hole into, because I don't know that they're ever really going to land on a third party culprit of like, it was you. And that's what we're going to talk about here in a second. But they're looking to insinuate that there might be. And that is reasonable doubt. The state has just renewed its motion to ban the jury from hearing any arguments about another suspect. They won that fight in the first trial. And obviously, you know, Becky Hill got involved and then everything went to shit. Should they have that in the second trial? Should they be banned from going down that third party culprit route, I guess is the question. I mean, unless you got a third party culprit, you know, there's ways of insinuating it. I mean, we saw it in the Karen Reed trial a while back, where it was insinuating that the officers, you know, did it without directly saying this specific person did this and then that person. It's just more of the idea that there was a conspiracy. Could they pitch that in this case and make a jury believe that there's something else going on behind the secretive curtains of Moselle or back in the woods, Robin?
I think they could. I think it's relatively easy if it's allowed to have happen. And that is, and you've interviewed her numerous times, and that's the housekeeper.
Yeah.
So the first thing that enters my mind, again, is I always take that behavior arc. I look at human behavior before all else, because that'll start giving me filters and areas to focus on. And I said it's the beginning of the segment, that is, when you talk to and listen to the housekeeper and other people in his life, but you start there first, you call her on a stand, she'll testify, I'm sure, again, and you ask a simple question: has Alex ever done anything for himself? Mm-hmm. Does he ever cook his own meals? Does he ever do his own laundry? Does he ever, literally, what does he ever do for himself? And so you then have her respond, which is, no, I did everything in the house. He was this lazy. He did this, he did this, he did this, according to what she said on your show and other places. So you're like, all right, so he never does anything for himself. And then you talk about all the other crazy things with attempted murders or stage murders for insurance claims and everything, which required another human being. Mm-hmm. And you just let it lie. that's what I would do, because right there, just by asking those questions, you're leaving reasonable doubt for someone. Well, he's never done anything on his own and taken care of his own problems himself. He always hires someone to take care of his own problems. So if they're allowed to bring it in, that's one thing I would definitely introduce. Because you don't have to name anyone. You're just saying the dude can't do anything for himself. I don't know.
I would say Blanca Simpson could honestly one of the strongest witnesses for the defense of Alec Murdaugh. I know she doesn't she doesn't believe that Alec Murdaugh, you know, is you know, scot-free on this or didn't do it. But she has presented, I think, ample interesting angles to the story of what she witnessed that day, of a mysterious truck driving around the property that she couldn't identify, and nobody seems to really know who it was. There's several things that she has brought up on this show about that day on that property leading up to the murders that were out of character, out of tune, and just didn't really make a lot of sense, that have never really been answered or never really investigated either. And I think you combine that with whatever you can pull out of Sled's investigation or lack thereof, all the missteps there, the not crossing of T's or dotting of I's, you find all of those areas, and you suddenly start to have a bit of a pool over here of stuff that just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. And with the right answers, it might. Well, there's context here. Okay, that truck makes sense. It was this or that. You've put this over here. Oh, okay. Well, that makes some more sense too. But until you have that, it's Mad Libs. It's filling in the blank, and it's people guessing. This is where the conspiracy theories start up. Eddie Smith, his friend, Cousin Eddie in this case. I've had his attorney on the show too. By the own admission of Murdaugh's own attorneys, allegedly once claimed that Smith failed a polygraph when he was asked about the murders. I'm not saying he did anything, and he has always denied it. He sat down for many interviews, many documentaries. He's talked about his experience there. I don't know. I mean, from everything I've seen of him, I don't know. I just don't know. I'm not here to say either way. But according to him, he had nothing to do with it. But I don't know. That's kind of a big thing to try and get admitted. And they're trying to keep this out as well. The Eddie Smith information, the polygraph evidence, they want that banned. They don't want a jury hearing that there was the guy that Alec later tried to convince to kill him for insurance money for his son, failed the polygraph about the actual murders. I don't know. That might make a jury go, reasonable doubt.
Yeah, it would. And I got lots of issues with the polygraph anyway. So here's how complicated the polygraph can be. Because if you don't understand, because again, I understand why they want to outlaw it from the jury, because unless you truly understand what the polygraph isn't, and the variability of the outcome of it, it's going to weigh very heavily, because the jury is going to say, well, he failed the polygraph, boom, you know, because they're going to take it as face value. Meanwhile, in reality, what could have triggered a reading of deception? So place yourself in a situation. So the polygraph measures physiological and emotional responses to stimulus. In other words, questions. And so it depends on what you as an individual think of that question gives your body's response to that question that the machine is reading. That's why they can say it's a truth detector. Not really. It's what it is. It's a biodetector. It registers differences in your biological makeup, you know, sweat glands, heartbeat, breathing rate, all these different sensors it has on you. It's going to register change. In other words, it's a super wobble detector. And when we hear something that's distressing in some way, our body wobbles. And so, for example, in this case, if he's asked the question, so what I would do is I would have asked a few other questions in there besides the one I saw, the ones they were asked. It was very specific towards the murder that day. The murders that day, and he wobbled on those questions, in other words, indicating deception. Now, granted, I'm not a licensed polygrapher. I just know a lot of them, and I know the process. What I would have added on there, since we know, I believe I know, that he was involved with the potential insurance fraud scheme of shooting him and everything, right?
Or he was, I mean, at least tried to be roped in by Alec.
Right. So I would ask him questions about that to do a comparison contrast, because in other words, he might have been thinking about all the other misdeeds he was doing when asked that question, and he'd have the same sort of response. So I would want to ask other questions, I know, because they're called control questions. You want to ask a lot of other questions of equal weight of things you do know that were at equal weight of potentially super fraud, like killing someone or attempting to kill someone or insurance fraud, to kind of see where they register on that physiological response to that stimulus before I came to a conclusion. Again, I'm not criticizing a polygrapher. I don't know what the context of it. Yeah. I'm just saying that's how complicated a polygraph can be. And to explain all that to a jury, it's easier for them to say he failed.
Which is why oftentimes you're not admissible in court.
Exactly.
There is a very good argument there as to why his answers showed a wobble, because God knows what else he was involved in with Alec Murdaugh.
It's why we never polygraphed Russians, because they lie about everything. So they flatline. They show, and when I say Russians, Russian intelligence officers, you know, when we're dealing with the spies, because when you believe the shit come out of your mouth, you don't look like you're lying.
Yeah, yeah. Your thoughts, that's what the prosecution wants to bring in. We're going to talk about the defense here in just a second. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue our conversation about Alec Murdaugh.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Now the other side, the other stack. Last week, the defense filed a demand that prosecutors go back over everything, every file, every deal, every disciplinary record on every witness and certify in writing within 30 days that nothing was held back this time. Days before that, they moved to stop SLED from touching the DNA under Maggie's fingernails because one more state test could erase it forever. Nobody in our comments thinks Alec Murdaugh is innocent. What they think is that the people who caught him keep handing him the keys. That happens
yep.
a lot. The defense is demanding prosecutors swear in writing that they searched everything and turned it all over. 30 days signed. And here's where that lands. Last year, text messages between Alec and Eddie Smith surfaced that the defense says they never got before the first trial. Harpootlin said those texts might have changed their whole strategy. So now the murderers' lawyers, or alleged murderers' lawyers, are demanding receipts from the prosecutors, and it sounds reasonable. What does that tell you? That's the question that we got. With Eddie Smith and getting this this information, that they handle these things over in writing, what does it tell me? It tells me that they're going to try and impeach anyone that goes on that stand who's going to tell a different story than what they're going to swear to right now. So basically, they're saying to the prosecution, you need to lock down right now any road you plan on going down here in terms of this evidence, so there's no surprises in court. And if we find something, and I do wonder this, I wonder if Harpootlin knows about some of the things that maybe being held back by the state, and if they continue to hold it back, it may fly up in court suddenly one day going, oh, by the way, we have this. What do you mean you have this? We didn't turn that over. You were supposed to, and now we have it, and you didn't do that. Why didn't you do that? In a way to impeach. There's a lot of things here. I mean, at the end of the day, this is how discovery works. Both sides need to play their part. Both sides need to play fair if we're going to get anywhere with this. The last thing we want is, you know, the third Alec Murdaugh trial in five more years. We want to get this thing done and done fair. And even Alec Murdaugh deserves a fair trial. Hence why we're even here right now. Becky Hill is the reason we're here. We thought he had a fair trial until she stuck her hands in the honey jar.
Remarkable, isn't it?
So what are they trying to do? I mean, they're trying to find places to poke holes. And they have every right to do so, because that's how the defense works.
Yeah. I'm I can't believe I'm saying these things or recognizing the importance of doing these things until I just listened to Bob Mata so much. I mean, really, you know, and I'll give him a pump even because it's Tuesdays with Bob, and Bob is actually covering the Lindsey Clancy case.
He's in person
for us. Yeah. So he's in it for us. But I'm going to bring the attention to the Gacy thing, Buried, his podcast on Buried, which is the Gacy case. He does an amazing job. It's why I understand what the defense is doing here of, and I'm going to put it in my layman terms of what defense attorneys do. The real job of defense attorneys is not to find their client innocent. Their job is to make sure the Constitution and the law is being upheld. Because without defense attorneys, without these people, without Murdaugh's defense attorneys doing this, you could have a lot of shoddy work. You could have a lot of railroading. Again, if you put Murdaugh as a suspect aside, this is why defense attorneys exist. They exist to uphold the Constitution, the rights, the protections that our first, was it, Sixth Amendments give us, the Bill of Rights. That's why they're in place, not to find people innocent, but to make sure the system is working the way it was intended to work for fair and equal justice. Otherwise, welcome to the world of Judge Dredd. And that's exactly why they exist. And so watching and listening, as frustrating as it is, because like you said, everyone believes he's guilty, that's not enough because that's not the legal process. And so his lawyers are doing what they do to make sure SLEDs did their job properly, to make sure that everyone, that's what their job is. Their job is to make sure everyone did exactly what they're meant to do within the legal bounds of what the Constitution and the Bill of Rights grants every single U.S. person. So I get it, as frustrating as it is.
Oh, and the thing, people like to be very selective about when they want to be on the side of the investigators and when they don't want to be on the side of the investigators. And it's always very much on who you think is the shittier person. And in this case, Alec Murdaugh usually wins that competition. But the reality, though, is just this last spring, a judge threw out a whole different indictment, not connected to the Murdaugh case, but connected to SLED with the same investigators on the Murdaugh case, the Colucci case. Look it up, because evidence that could have helped the defense never got turned over. So this very thing that we've been talking about of why is it important to turn all these things over? Because if you don't, here's what can happen. The same system, same era, same problem. This is not ancient history. That was this spring. That was a few months ago. So that is one of the big reasons that Murdaugh's attorneys are citing for the demand, 30 days, give us everything you got, turn it all over, because we're not going to screw around with you and the games that you already appear to have been playing in other cases. If you have a department that's doing that with one case, you can sure as shit bet they're probably doing it on others. It's not usually an isolated incident.
Yeah, I completely agree. And as great Bob Mata says, just do the work. And so I said, you know, I know we didn't talk about it today, but we did before the show. You know, it's why cases like the Nancy Guthrie case terrify me if they actually get the guy that they think is a suspect. And not because of anything else, that I pray to God that the investigators aren't disheveled and disorganized and as haphazard as Nanos has been on air. Because if they are, whoever it is they get, they got a high probability of walking because discover they're going to be able to squash all the suppressions they're going to maybe do because of how the case may have been handled. Again, if you're looking for how things are handled at the top, if it filtered down, that's a potential disaster. That's why when you are assigned these positions, you really do due diligence. That's why I hated doing evidence response team stuff, because the precision, the accuracy, the chain of custody, the gloves, the every single document. I mean, the work you had to do on evidence response for just these purposes is beyond my 50,000 foot brain. This is at the granular level, and I do not operate well at the granular level. That's why you got to dot the I's and cross the T's, because otherwise it can be deemed unconstitutional and defense will have it thrown out. And then you wasted a lot. Think about the amount of wasted time that could be done and the injustice that is done and a guilty man walks if they don't do it the right way. And conversely as well.
Well, I would love to know, honestly, if other people are involved in this. I mean, everybody wants to crucify Alec Murdaugh, and I think there's plenty of crucifying that is well-deserved there. But I have always wondered if there is someone else involved, and not that he isn't involved, but whoever else might be involved should probably also be prosecuted, if they exist. And I don't have a clear path to say, yes, I think that's for sure. I maybe like 20, 30% thinking there might be somebody else involved. I'm like 70, 80 that it was 100, that it was him. 70, 80 that it was 100% him. 70, 80% him, maybe 20, 30 somebody else. I don't know. The DNA fight is the one that a lot of people are talking about, because when you sample DNA material, it runs through testing. I'm not a DNA tester. I don't do it as a side hustle, but I know there's only so much DNA you can test. It's not like, oh, it's here and everybody can go test it their own way. No, everybody gets there. It's a limited amount of the cookie that everyone gets, and eventually you're out of crumbs. And they're down to the last smidgen of crumb, basically. And the state wants to test the DNA under her fingernail again. The defense is saying, wait a second, we should probably do that too. You've already tested it once, and this is where you got, or you didn't test it correctly. So we want to run it as well. Where that could possibly lead, and it might lead absolutely nowhere. This could be a big nothing burger for the defense, where it's like, well, it's inconclusive, or it turns out to be very explainable in some way, shape, or form. But DNA under a fingernail, I mean, it's not hard to get someone else's DNA under your fingernail if, oh, I don't know, say you go shopping and you pick up an item at the store. I mean, it is transferable. It's mm-hmm. It's very easily gotten from non-nefarious means. But wouldn't it be interesting if you could name whose DNA was under Maggie's fingernail? And what a story that would tell, especially if it's someone identifiable within the circle of World Murdaugh.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, why wouldn't you have evidence included? I mean, it makes no sense to me why you wouldn't for no. prosecution or defense. I mean, it's there. It raises questions, and you have to flush those out. You know, when we talk about all these cases, you know, the Murdaugh case as well as the Guthrie case, Nolan Wells. All these cases, you cover every single lead you get, and you flush it out until you determine what it is, what it isn't, and then you include it. And so we have DNA under a fingernail. Yeah, you got to include it. I don't know why you wouldn't have it tested.
You know, I think a question everyone needs to ask themselves about any case that they look at, if they truly want justice, if you're arguing not to test something to its fullest extent, or to go down the lane to get the answer when it is achievable to get, and you don't want to go there, you don't want whatever side to go there to find it, what is your reasoning as to why you don't want them to get there? If it's just an absolute answer that can be achieved, what is the motivation to not get there? And if it's because, well, that might disagree with the way you think the case should go or the conclusion you want, then your motivation's not pure. You're not interested in justice. You're interested in your side winning, in your conjecture being correct. And when it comes to justice, it's not about that. It's about getting to the truth. And that's what is lost so many times in these cases.
Critical thinking.
Yeah. And that's what we need a bit more of these days. So there you go. We'll cover the hearing on Friday, and you'll get updates on all of that. And we'll see where it goes, because there's going to be some critical things decided here on Friday. Maybe not quite decided, but argued Friday. And then we'll see how long it takes McCaslin to make a ruling. Sometimes that can be days, weeks, who knows. But it will really set the stage for what this trial is going to look like 8 months from now, if we hit that date. I still think it could be pushed out, but who knows? We'll find out. We will have a spring of Alec Murdaugh. Get your Alec Murdaugh Easter decorations. I'm personally going to do Easter eggs this year with Alec's picture on the side of the eggs.
I can't wait to see the AI stuff you produce with that.
It's going
to
be great. The Murdaugh bunny will be coming. And,
the Murdaugh bunny. Yeah, the slobbery Murdaugh bunny.
Snot dripping down.
Yes.
Nobody wants to sit in his lap. Yeah. Your thoughts in the comment section and Substack and YouTube on on the Murdaugh case and everything we're talking there about here. We're looking forward to that. Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me. It's available wherever you get books and audiobook. Leave a review on Apple, or leave a review rather on Amazon. Greatly appreciated there. All right. Until next time, for Todd and Robin, I'm Tony. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Normally in these ads, you'd expect someone like me to ask you to buy something, but I want to ask you to do something different. I'm Dave Farenthold, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm an investigative reporter, which means that I follow the money, inside of government and outside of government. The point of my job is to find things people are trying to hide. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves looking through lots and lots of documents. And if there weren't folks like me to go beyond the surface to understand who is really shaping what the government does, the public would be left in the dark about what the government's doing with your tax money, what the government's doing to you through regulations and spending. If you're like me and you think this kind of journalism is important, seek out a news source that does firsthand, fact-based reporting. If that's the New York Times, thank you. If that's your local paper, that's great too. Because where you get your information matters.